The subject for our talk today is, as you know, standards of conduct. Standards or norms of behavior, of action, from the point of view of a spiritual seeker. As is commonly admitted today, the time is past when one standard or a set of standards of conduct were expected to be followed by all the people in history, at any rate in medieval history. Each chieftain, each leader of men wanted to impose the standards of his community, his collectivity, on all those whom he would conquer. And they were very sincere, very earnest in their belief that their standards of conduct were the ultimate, were those that would do good to all the people. There is a legend, perhaps it is more than a legend, that when the Caliph of Turkey conquered Alexandria in one of his military conquests, he ordered the magnificent library of Alexandria to be burnt down. Then he was asked why he would burn such a treasure of works, of wisdom. He said, if the books in the library are contrary to the dictates of Quran, then they are dangerous and they should be burnt. If, however, they conform to the teachings of Quran, they are redundant. In either case, they are to be burnt. Now, this is a typical mentality of a narrow-bound human mind, which considers that the standards it practices are the ultimate ones. In India, it has always been recognized that standards vary with the competence of the people concerned. In Indian society, there are gradations, there are clear marked demarcations of competence. They call it here dharma. Dharma is not religion, is not conduct, but action according to the ruling law of self-being. At each stage in man's life, there is a particular law of operation. The conduct must correspond to that. Accordingly, the Indian seer devised a system of four stages in life of man: that of a celibate student, of the householder, of the retiring aged man, and the recluse. There are severe standards for the celibate student, which are relaxed when he matured and came of an age when he could marry and lead a responsible life as a member of the society. More responsibilities were added at the time of his retirement from active life, and once He has fulfilled his obligations to society, to his family, and he chose to walk into the freedom, wilderness of the freedom of spirit. He was absolved from conforming to any of the standards. The question is asked, and very naturally, does that mean that a recluse, that a spiritual seeker who has chosen to walk beyond the rules of the society can do as he likes? Can he give up the laws of morality and be immoral? Is it not an encouragement to people to be immoral in the name of religion and spirituality? These are very legitimate questions, but considered in the proper perspective, they lose their ground. For how, after all, standards come into act? Be it. Sri Aurobindo explains in his chapter on the subject in the Synthesis of Yoga, which I hope all of you have read, that in the universe there is a great force, creative force of evolution, a divine force in action. And every individual action, whether he is conscious of it or not, is a segment, is a part of this cosmic universal action that goes on. As man becomes conscious of his part in this universal activity, his attitude to men and things changes. In the beginning, when he is mostly unconscious of the fact that he is but a segment of the universal sector, he is ruled by the needs, or what he fancies to be the needs, the desires of his physical body and vital energy. All the rules, all the norms that he erects are with a view to subserve this primary need. At this age, man is primarily a physical man. And whatever standards he erects are subservient to this condition. The needs of the physical body, the need of the life force to aggrandize itself, to draw upon others, to draw upon the environment for its own enjoyment. This is the need. This is the standard. In most of the Aboriginal societies, you find that this norm, this standard is common. But very soon man finds that he does not live alone. He is a member of a collectivity. First his family, then his clan, then his society, then his tribe. He draws upon the collectivity, and the collectivity forces him to serve the society. Where his individual standards of self-effectuation and self-aggrandizement clash with similar standards erected by other individuals, there is a friction. There has to be a compromise, and the social law comes into operation. The social and the collective standards thus emerge into existence. First aim at a certain control of the predatory instinct of the life energy of the human being, and ensure that individual interests are accommodated to the collective interests. as far as possible, they are harmonized with the interests of other individuals. But there is a conflict, an ever-existent conflict, between the individual and society. The individual claims that the society is a field for his development, and he is not wrong. He draws upon the wealth, collective wealth around. He exploits the potential of mind, life and matter around him, and he wishes to be the monarch. However, nature counters this claim and effort of the individual with another emphasis, the emphasis on the claim of the society on the individual. After all, it is said, the individual is but a cell in the corporate body. A cell cannot exist except as a part of the larger being. It feeds upon it, and it is indispensable, if the individual is to survive and progress, that he subordinates himself and participates in the common communal progress. With this friction on both sides, nature tries experiment after experiment, and strives to strike a balance between the needs of the individual and the claims of the society. That is where the standards of conduct of the individual and the standards of conduct erected by the society first come into conflict, then they compromise. But a compromise, as Sri Aurobindo points out, is hardly a solution. It only complicates matters in the end. And the third stage arrives when some leading thinker, they perceive that the true law is neither one's own physical or vital interest, nor the same interest extended on a larger scale to cover the community, but some kind of ideal which both must serve. There comes in ethics. People conceive of some law of the eternal, some law of God, which should control and rule man's conduct. Different seers and different thinkers conceive of it differently. However, each society erects its own more of ethics, its own ideals of perfection, and tries to put it into practice. Indeed, the lag between practice and precept is big, but still, the very fact that an effort is being made, at any rate in the advanced section for the awakened society, to practice this norm of ideal, this injunction of ethics, is an indication that man has advanced beyond the first elementary stages, and he has emerged into the domain of mind. It is no longer the body, no longer the life force, but it is the mind, the enlightened mind that has begun to claim man. Here too, man finds the conflict between the different ideals erected in different climes and different times. Some would conceive the ruling ideal to be justice, some would hold it to be knowledge, some love, some strength. There is a conflict. Justice may demand what love prohibits. Love may call for something which justice would not allow. This continual conflict in the awakened conscience of man between the several erected ideals convinces him after a time that that is not the ultimate state. What he has been trying is only a mental transcription of still some higher verities of the divine being. He tries to translate in human terms, in terms of his understanding. There are stages in the life of man. There are stages in the progress of society where ethics have to be enforced, rules of morality have to be observed. But it should be recognized that they are not the be-all and end-all of human existence. We in India are very familiar with this great error of some of our leaders who have raised ethical ideals to absolute standard and have not hesitated to sacrifice the interests of millions of people at the altar of their ideal, which they wrongly conceived to be the universal law. Non-violence is one such idea. Whether non-violence is a practical ideal for humanity in its present state of existence is a problematic question. Actually, non-violence is a law of another plane than our earth, physical earth, where nature is red in tooth and claw. Thinkers, deep thinkers, have begun to perceive that these ideals are after all man-made, mind-made. And as the mind develops, they begin to see the limitations of these ethical ideas. All the same, it is a rule of spiritual life that one cannot forsake an ideal which has governed his life until he is ready to take up another ideal. I am reminded of an incident which happened some 3 or 4 years ago when we had some visitors from the continent, Europe, continent of Europe, rather boisterous young men whom I wanted to befriend and arranged for their stay in one of our guest houses. They went wild. They started stealing things wherever they went, behaving very wild, and when someone spoke to them of the ashram discipline, of the need to observe certain decorum, they said, "We do not believe in all these rules and things, we are out to break them." And they would not go. After that period, the period for which I had permitted them to stay was over, when I asked them to leave, they would not. So it was, I had to speak to Mother about what had happened. Then she took out a paper and wrote, because they are from France and they didn't know much English, she wrote in French that you have no right to break a law unless and until you are ready for a higher law. That's all that she wrote. I had it sent to the gentleman, the leader of the party. When it was shown, his face beamed, he smiled, and they left the next day. I am telling this just to emphasize that it is all right to speak that the standards of the past, they have no relevance. Yes, they have no relevance, provided we have crossed into another state of consciousness, into another realm of being, which is beyond the application of that earlier law or idea. Mother has said 100 times that it is not right to disturb the faith of one person. However unenlightened it may appear to you, unless you can replace it by another faith, a greater and a deeper faith, till then you cannot disturb. So these laws and standards and norms and mores of ethics, of morality, they have a part to play in the evolutionary development of man as long as his animal nature is not completely left behind, as long as he continues to be ruled by his ego, by his desire, these checks are necessary. More so, to guard him from his own error. When one is ready, when one has realized all that the ethics can contribute to one's development, when ethical rules have become a barrier for further progress, when man-made rules and conventions clearly stand and obstruct your mental and spiritual progress in consciousness, then is the time to leave aside all the standards and look to still higher standards, which are the self-formulations of the divine law of truth. The divine truth, again, formulates itself into several verities, those of love, those of knowledge, those of power, those of compassion. And each one, when one arrives at that plane, they work harmoniously, without conflict, and help the individual to radiate their truth in the society. Because even when man has arrived and men have arrived at the spiritual level of consciousness, it is not that the whole of society is ready for it. Man will always be ahead. The individual is always the key of progress. Even in the spiritual realm, it is the individual who has to lead the society. He has to be the torchbearer of the Gnostic consciousness. As individuals multiply, who govern themselves by still higher rules and standards of spiritual conduct, as some sort of cohesion and solidarity emerges by their common living, a collective soul is formed in the mold of the spiritual consciousness. It is somewhat a misnomer to call the spiritual working as laws or standards. They are not what these words mean at our level. The spiritual truth, the spiritual law, works differently with different individuals. Fundamentally it is the same, but in application it differs. This is the great difference between a spiritual law and an ethical law. Ethical law insists on being applied uniformly in all cases, but the spiritual law applies itself individually, differently in each case, depending upon the need of the situation, the level of the consciousness, the nature of the cause. Man has to learn to be Catholic, to be plastic, flexible in his approach, before he can assimilate the truth of the divine and the spiritual standards. It is when these divine standards of conduct, self-effective, we do not need a promulgation, which are self-evident, which one does not need to be told that this is the law, but which one feels spontaneously, and one acts without being goaded by external circumstances in that direction. They are the forms of the spiritual standard. When, whether humanity has arrived at a stage when this rule of the highest standards of conduct can be natural is a problematic question. Prophets have spoken, poets have sung of the kingdom of God on earth, the golden age, the age of truth. But it really depends upon the number and the quality of individuals who first realize this state of existence in their own lives. As long as men continue to be circumscribed by their personal vision, ruled by their ego in whatever way it may masquerade, as long as individuals, the chosen individuals, do not have that sense of universality, that sense of unity in soul with others, all talk of spiritual standards, the Gnostic consciousness, the supramental way of living is academic. Let us then start with what is possible for us at this stage in our evolutionary development. Let us cease to be separate individuals, at any rate in our consciousness, in our way of thinking, in our way of feeling. We know mentally, all of us know mentally, that we are one at a certain level. There is a divine consciousness and a divine being where we are one, from whom we are derived. Let each one of us make it a habit at a certain time of the day to retire into our depths and from there feel the unity with all, and universalize ourselves in our thoughts, in our feelings. First by imagination, then by thought, then by feeling, which is ultimately developed into actual life, when one covers the whole of the universe with one's love, with one's consciousness that embraces all on earth, that would be a grand and a fit beginning. It was only a practical division of life, so many stages, which were expected to apply on an average scale. But those who were awakened, who felt the call, were not obliged to pass through the three stages. They could withdraw and go to their quest at any stage. And even there was provision to provide for them, these seekers, with mental discipline and enlightenment. They could skip, all that they could do was to skip the householder stage. And it was expected that even the And it was expected that even the stage of sannyasa, it has its own rules, own discipline, to see that the spiritual energies were channeled into the right way, that there was no possibility of self-deception and regression. Rules are provided, collectivities are formed to take care of these seekers. But after the seeker arrives at a certain fulfillment, he would be bound by none. He would not even be a sannyasi. He would be what they call in Sanskrit a parivrajaka. The nearest English translation would be, it is not correct, but a recluse, they say. That is, he is not a member of the society. He insists on having his own way of life. Then the question arises, particularly in the tantras, that if he is not bound, he may do anything. If morality does not bind him, he can be easily immoral in the name of God. But the fact is, when one has arrived at the state of consciousness, which automatically places him in a category which is not ruled by these things, it is unthinkable that he can get the impulse to go back to the animal state and break sub-ethical rules, indulge in sub-ethical practices. The man has gone beyond supra-ethical state normally. He cannot slide back into the infra-ethical. If he does, it means there was a weakness. There was a corner in his being which was not attended and which has come forward. One just does not feel after a certain stage it human, dignified, to indulge in unethical practice. A supra-ethical man, take it from me, is never unethical. He is never immoral. He may be immoral. It doesn't matter to him, but he is not. He does not. His indifference to morality comes here when another person, by weakness, unable to stand a temptation, turns immoral. That does not disqualify him in the eyes of the supra-ethical man from receiving his compassion and grace. He does not condemn a man because he is not ethical. But an ethical man will condemn you 1,000 times. Even an ethical saint will do it. But not a supra-ethical man, a spiritual man. His heart goes out in compassion to help the distressed. The distress are not always the physically and the materially distressed. There are those who are psychologically distressed. Their misery, their suffering is much more to be deplored, much more pitiable than those who are denied material wants, material needs. Almost all the religions of the world have today ceased to be of utility to the spiritual seeker because all of them practically, at any rate as they were practiced, were loaded heavily with this ethical content, which was all right at the time they were promulgated. In the conditions, in the countries in which they came into existence. Times have changed, humanity has progressed farther. They do not need to be told, do not tell a lie, you will be punished. A man feels, when he tells a lie, he feels that he has done something infraction. That stage is over, the age of religions is over, the age of ethics is over.
New consciousness and manifestations in some lives of a guiding power that moves from within in the regulation of action. Is that a part of what Sri Aurobindo says in this chapter, the movement of a power, a force infinite and divine in its origin and secret sense, is preparing to lead us to a spiritual realization? Is that a manifestation?
There is that divine power, that secret sense pervading, looming over the world. But what happens? Different centers, different receptive individuals receive it differently. They conceive of it differently. And each one expresses in the measure of his understanding, governed by his environmental factors. Chardin will speak of one in one term, another person in America will speak in another way, but all of them refer to the phenomenon of an emerging consciousness. But the nature of the consciousness that Sri Aurobindo speaks is not precisely what has been understood and formulated in their thought or system by the thinkers. It is a transcription in their consciousness, in their mental consciousness of what is going on. Sri Aurobindo had explained long ago that when certain truths are going to manifest, they find expression wherever there is some opening, maybe anywhere, at any level. So the expression naturally may differ depending upon the level of perception, the level of grasping. It can also be that the same truths are expressed identically in two different places. That is because the same truth is pressing all over. For the truth that is pressing, there is no time nor space. A new consciousness, as they say, the content of that consciousness is different from the content of the truth consciousness of which Mother and Sri Aurobindo speak. They are thinking ultimately in terms of humanity, perfection of humanity within the present comforts, eliminating the drawbacks and all that. Humanity to be perfected at its present highest level. They do not conceive that humanity is a stage leading to another level of consciousness, the intermediate race, which has to come form and rule before the supramental race can project itself on earth. There is still a big gap between the highest ranks of humanity today and the supramental being. The intermediate being functioning with the natural mind of light has still to come. The omega point mentioned by Chardin does not go even as far as this intermediate race. The intermediate race is in the process of being formed. One thing is, a supramental individual can come anytime, just as even a spiritual man could appear and live when most of the humanity was purely physical. All formations are not present on the physical plane.
Yes.
There are so many planes. Formations are constantly gathering, and they are precipitating themselves on the physical plane. So, lot of forms are still being worked out on the subtler plane. And it is very much in the likelihood that the intermediate individual, the supramental individual, can appear, and if the past example of evolution, history of evolution, is to be believed, is to be repeated, it will be a precipitation. The first man to appear on earth was not a direct product of evolution. The ape evolution brought it up to a point where further evolution, further change was not possible at that level. It was then that the creative divine projected the human type from the subtler plane, and thereafter a possibility was formed for man to emerge. So the first man was a precipitation, not a direct evolution. That is why the scientists are speaking of the missing link. Missing link is there, not here. Similarly, as I conceive it, as I have reason to believe, the first supramental man will be precipitated on earth by an occult process, of which Sri Aurobindo has spoken in some way in the book Supramental Manifestation, in the chapter, I believe, of Divine Body. But it presupposes certain conditions on earth which are ready. The eighth evolution had brought it to a climactic point, so that nature could assimilate and support the higher evolution, the higher species. Similarly, a solid ground must be prepared in the mind of humanity, which will support the charge, the manifestation of the supramental man. And that is precisely the role of institutions like ashram, like Auroville, to prepare the favorable ground, the receptive ground, for the higher manifestation to take place. He manifested directly. Mother even said that one time it was somewhere in the Central Asia that he just is precipitated. He didn't have our all these present form, but the rudiments. But they were different from the ape, but similar to our human body.
Mother said the first man was much higher, but he had to come down because he was so much higher than almost we are today. But he had to come down to bring the others up. Yeah. Who are the others he had to bring up?
The other levels of creation. Other levels of creation. Even as today, if the supramental consciousness comes down or has been working, it does get diluted in its process of integration. It can't grow only on the top. It has to go down, dilute itself, mix itself with the inferior levels of consciousness, uplift them, change them, transmute them. In the process, there is naturally an apparent coming down. Even in the humanity, in our original age, men were very intuitive. Without having to reason, without having to calculate mentally, they could arrive at solutions, they could see things as they are, without the barrier, in spite of the barrier of outside forms and all that, the Vedic age, the old Greek age and all that. But afterwards, the consciousness had to come down to take up the mental reason, to take up the vital emotions, to take up the physical body. So that process is still going on. But it does not mean that our ancestors were superior to us. They were born with certain faculties. Now we are much richer in this sense that more faculties are active in us than among those.